Hey everybody, this is Trevin McGee from the Scene Stealers podcast. Happy Friday, and I'm here today with my partners in crime. We're back. We got a lot of movies to talk about today, including but not limited to Spider-Man, Ted. We're going to talk about Ted, Safety Not Guaranteed, and Lola Versus. Am I leaving any out, guys?
Moonrise Kingdom.
Moonrise Kingdom, some little movie by, I don't know, some director I've never heard of. So yeah, let's go ahead and get started. How are you guys doing tonight, anyway?
Doing great.
Yeah.
Good.
It's Friday.
I'm doing good. I got a beer.
Okay, well.
I'm hanging out in my office in my underwear.
You're super quick to respond.
I have this goblet of water.
That's a nice goblet. Where did you get such a goblet?
Those
are glass breasts on that goblet. What is that about?
It's from Treasure Island Casino.
Oh, nice.
The 2 for $10 special.
Oh. Well, that's a savings and a value. So I guess we should start off with the big budget blockbuster movie of the week. So, Eric, they lifted the embargo early on Spider-Man, which is kind of unheard of for big summer movies. Actually, it comes out, what, July 3rd? Is that right?
Tuesday the 3rd.
Yeah. So it comes out July 3rd, but they're going to let us talk about it now. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about Spider-Man?
Okay, so it's called The Amazing Spider-Man, Trevin, if you will.
Yeah. I won't, but we can.
What I like to refer to it is the movie that is not Spider-Man 4. And when I say I like to refer to it that, I actually wish that Spider-Man 4 existed. I was a big fan of the Sam Raimi series as much as Spider-Man 3 was kind of a letdown. Mm-hmm. I think they should have been given a chance to kind of put that franchise back on track, especially after the heights of Spider-Man 2. But instead, Sony chose to not deliver Raimi. Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst, their big, huge paycheck because they didn't want to cover that kind of a budget. And they went with Mark Webb, who did 500 Days of Summer, mm-hmm. and Andrew Garfield, who was in The Social Network, and Emma Stone, who's in every movie ever made in the last 5 years. So basically what they did is they rebooted the character. And it's funny because all the advanced press on this said, well, we're not going to reboot the character. This is the untold story. They rebooted the character.
Right.
It is an origin story. As much as they don't want people to know that, it is an origin story.
It's the wicked version of Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, there is certainly that element. So let me just get into the basic thing this movie that I won't say. As familiar as the story will feel, especially to people who've seen previous three Spider-Man films, taken on its own, at its merit, this is a very effective, well-made superhero movie that I think gets the essence of Peter Parker correct while kind of updating him a little bit for what most teenagers would probably consider to be somebody that they can relate to more than, let's say, a teenager from the 60s or 70s, which is how I kind of felt Sam Raimi was going for in the original series. Andrew Garfield is a really great actor, and he does a lot of subtle work in this movie, making Spider-Man more of a reckless type character. So there's kind of a more what's going to happen next vibe that you didn't really get before because you knew that Maguire was going to have that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, but that's still in the movie. Not that line specifically, but that's still the main theme of the film. It's right. Just that in 1 hour, he turns into Spider-Man, and he goes through pretty big tragedies in this movie, and it's almost just wanted to get all this back out of the way in one film that they could move with this reinterpretation of the character. There's no way to pretend that they hit these other movies, but after I hopped on it, woke up the next morning, started thinking about it, I was thinking about the missteps in the film, and there's very few. It's really a really well-together movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have a question, and we may need the Dome of Thunder down, or whatever it is, the spoiler dome. Are the webs organic or machine-made?
Machine.
The machine, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
did they show that in the trailer?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I'm not a huge fan of the comic books. I don't read them. I read them when I was a kid. But from what I've heard, and Gavin can correct me if I'm wrong, certainly Alan and Aaron over at Dad's Big Plan will, that this is more true to, one, the Spider-Man origin stories, at least, that is out there.
It's more true to which one? You're kind of slipping in and out of the Matrix. I can't.
Oh, okay. Well, apparently there's the Ultimate Superman, and then there's the original Superman. And
okay.
I believe it is more true to the original Spider-Man story.
Oh, okay.
So this is just more true to what we think of as Spider-Man.
Well, no, more true to the actual plot of the comic. So Mary Jane Watson was the second girlfriend, not the first one. The Lizard is now an employee at Oscorp. We know is the Goblin from the film. And so what they're really doing is they're backing up a little bit, and they're taking all the deposits from the first film and exploring their ends instead of just jumping right in like the first one did.
Sure.
Makes sense.
But it's pretty good?
It is.
Yeah.
It's a real made film. I keep saying it because it's kind of unremarkable just because we've seen this kind of movie before, and so it suffers from that. But I think that if this was the first movie that anybody ever saw with Spider-Man in it, they would think it was amazing. And they would probably be raving about it the way I was in 2002 when I saw the original. Now, that said, it doesn't touch Spider-Man 2, which I think is the high point of the superhero genre.
For someone that's used to these movies, and like you're saying, like if this was the first one you'd seen, is there still something to like grab those people that have seen this, or do you just go in expecting what you're gonna see?
And what do you mean by grab?
like when you went in, was there anything that really got you going about the movie? I mean, or was it just like it's just a well-made film and you kind of saw what you were expecting?
There are slight differences in the character, and I think some more efficient plot developments, good use of all of the backstory. A lot of people said they're trying to make Spider-Man too much like Batman because of the death of his parents and all that kind of stuff. That stuff's all there, but I don't think there's anything that's going to shock anybody.
Yeah.
But I think that's good because if they would have done a wild reinterpretation, I think it wouldn't have been true to Peter Parker. And so I just think that they're trying to make Peter Parker more relatable to teenagers today rather than teenagers from, you know, the 50s and 60s.
How did it look in IMAX?
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. So in IMAX, the screen never expands like it does in the night. So it's completely worthless in IMAX. I don't know why anybody would go see it in IMAX. Even worse, the film is not entirely in 3D. I found this out because, yeah, I was watching, and at one point I noticed there wasn't any depth of field, so I just took my glasses off, and sure enough, that scene that I was watching, which was a character scene between two people, wasn't even being projected in 3D, but then all of a sudden an action scene started and everything got blurry and I had to put my glasses back on. That said, even the action scenes aren't that impressive in 3D. I'm pretty sure this was converted, so don't bother in IMAX. Don't bother in 3D.
All right.
So you don't need 3D or IMAX, either one.
No, I mean, honestly, this is a really good character drama. I can't stress the Emma Stone, Andrew Garfield relationship enough. They did a great, great job with that. We've got two really appealing actors who have obvious chemistry, and it's just a nice setup for, I think, what everything is that's going to come after this. The Lizard, the special effects, the character design of his face. I understand they were going for a combination of CGI and a mask, and makeup and costume effects, which I think is admirable, but I think they kind of failed. But I'm not going to discount the movie because I think the Lizard looked cool.
So what's your rating?
Yeah, where do you come down on this?
Solid rock fist up.
Solid.
All right. And, oh, hey, runtime. That's the other thing. How long is the thing?
It's about 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Okay.
That's, and it takes about an hour for him to turn into Spider-Man, which I think was a perfect amount of time.
All right. Well, let's move on then. Let's talk about a movie that comes out this week that let's switch it up, actually. You guys got to see Moonrise Kingdom. Why don't you both attack Moonrise Kingdom and tell me whether or not I should go see it?
Adam and I were pretty much in agreement. It was funny because I think both of us, you have to do the exit interview whenever you go to a screening, and both of us were a little hesitant about being the first one to go. And so I think I just dove in finally, and then Adam kind of followed me up. And we were both surprised at how close our assessment of this movie was. For a little bit of plot synopsis, just so you know, and then I'll let Adam kind of, you know, take it away from there. But Wes Anderson, you know, kind of king of awkward familial comedies.
Which you can see a top 10 on the website.
Yeah, Adam did an awesome awkward moments top 10. So he revisits his kind of, I mean, a lot of comparisons are going to be made to Rushmore. This is kind of the preteen Rushmore in some ways. So you have a young boy and a young girl who have decided to rendezvous and run away together. The young boy is an orphan. The young girl is misunderstood by her parents and is kind of a troubled child. She acts out violently, you find out.
Sounds hilarious.
It's very funny. But they decide to run away together, and it's basically their adventure together on this small northeastern island in, you know, in the kind of New England, you know, northeast. And that's sort of the basic setup. You've got some kind of you've got some indie heavy hitters. You've got Bill Murray and Francis McDormand. You also have Ed Norton, who after this movie, I'm kind of sad that I haven't seen more of him recently.
That's awesome.
You've got Bruce Willis kind of turning in his indie performance, which he does occasionally. So every now and then he'll show up in the indie world, and usually it's a pretty fun surprise.
Yeah, he was good in Breakfast Champions.
See, I didn't see Breakfast with Champions.
Wait, are you being sarcastic or are you being serious?
That's one of the most unwatchable movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible.
And I love Kurt Vonnegut. Apparently can't adapt Kurt Vonnegut, so.
No,
well, yeah. But anyway, I mean, so you've got kind of this pretty amazing cast of people, and they're all, you know, sort of Bill Murray and Francis McDormand play the parents of the young girl. Bruce Willis plays the town's police officer. So when the young, I guess it's a Boy Scout. I can't remember what they called them. It's a khaki scout. When the young khaki scout runs away, Bruce Willis is called to help track him down. And you find out that Francis McDormand's character and Bruce Willis's character are having some sort of an affair.
Spoiler dome, jeez.
Jeez, Trey, thanks a lot. Let's talk about the Wes Anderson elements of the film.
All right. I'll let Adam do that. So you've got plenty of plot synopsis. You know where we're at. So I'll let Adam take it away for that part.
Okay. Watching Moonrise Kingdom, you can definitely tell that it is a Wes Anderson film. There's all the classic elements, the flat shots, really, really awesome color schemes. Slow motion shots, just all of the stuff that you've seen. But I will say that throughout the first half of the movie, I was totally not into it. I expected to just be raving about it at the end, in the first, what was it, about like an hour before it really...
It was, you know, I'm not sure whether it was just the first act, so about half an hour into it, or if it was really like 45 minutes, like if it was halfway through the film, but it was somewhere in there. The first half of the film, he kind of relies too much on what people expect, so he whip pans you to death. You know, he just kind of quirks out all over the place. Part of that is because there is some necessary explication, but part of it also is that he's relying on the tools and the toys that he has become accustomed to using. But it's so apparent that it's distracting.
First half is just so full force in your face that it almost seems like it is excruciating to get to the next half. Like it's really, really rushed, but at the same time, it just feels like it feels like a snail moving along.
Because so a lot of times in Wes Anderson movies, they're funny, but all of his comedy is mixed with melancholy. And the ones that I like the best are the ones that actually pull out these unexpected small moments of poignancy. Does this movie have that?
We should probably drop the spoiler dome because there are a couple of really what?
No spoilers. I haven't seen it yet. I don't want to know spoilers.
All right. Yeah. All right.
Yes, so, it does.
There are those moments.
But I feel as though he's trying really hard for them in the first part of the movie. He's setting us up for this dramatic ending, but I just feel like we're flopping throughout the first half. And I think a lot of it, he's relying on his typical dry humor, you know, like he usually does. But I think that because he's having kids convey this humor to us, it's a little awkward. Like it's just not quite hitting the spot that it needs to hit. It's just slightly
off. So are the kids are they not as good as Jason Schwartzman and Rushmore? Are they having a harder time with the West End?
Oh, I think it's undeniable. They are not as good as Jason Schwartzman in Rushmore.
But it also, I think it also is because they're a lot younger than he was.
Yeah.
It's Kara Hayward who plays Susie and Jared Gilman who plays Sam. And I think it's actually both of their first major appearances.
Yeah, the only other thing I saw were some interviews that they did in regards to this film.
This is kind of a tepid response from me. So I was expecting positivity.
Well,
yeah, I just have no interest.
You know, and I will say this: this film, after there's a moment, and this won't spoil anything, but there's a moment where these two kids are together. And they're in the kind of this secluded cove, and they actually get some breathing room, and you get to see their relationship kind of develop and deepen. Once that moment happens, then the film just Wes Anderson kind of allows the film to sort of open up and gives his characters the breathing room to just, you know, be. Once that happens, this film is really, really affecting.
It's solid.
I mean, it is very affecting. I mean, it really, you know, I think that there are a couple of moments. In fact, I would say that there is a moment between Bill Murray and Frances McDormand that I think is one of the best and most emotionally driven moments in any of his films.
I would just say that it is probably the best one I personally feel. It's probably the heaviest, I mean, it's some of the heaviest dialogue I've seen, you know, and it's so awkward because what they're not saying is conveying what they're actually talking about.
Yeah. I mean, so yes, we're kind of belaboring the first half of the movie because the first half of the movie makes you work to, I mean, you have to kind of get through the clutter. But the last half of the movie is so good that it's, you know, by the time I walked out, I recognized that I had been through that first half and that it was okay, but not great. But I didn't care. I was totally fine with it. So You know, that's kind of what I would say to people. Is it like if you're feeling sort of ho-hum about it about half an hour in, if you're a Wes Anderson fan, if you can stick with it, I think it's a totally worthwhile and worthy payoff. And I think the last half of the film is amazing. He kind of proves the Charlie Kaufman adaptation rule, which is dazzle him in the end and you'll have him.
So with Rushmore as the undisputed champion and best film Wes Anderson has ever made, where does this rank among the rest of them?
I'd probably put this somewhere close. Like, I think Rushmore is great. I actually think Bottle Rocket is kind of his underrated film. I think that movie's great. I would probably rank this. I think Rushmore, for me, is still kind of his perfect film. And this would be below that, somewhere around Tenenbaums and Bottle Rocket. So, but I'm not sure Adam could have a different assessment.
What?
That's still pretty high.
Yeah. I think I'm really satisfied. I did not like Darjeeling at all.
Yeah.
I thought Darjeeling was I found it almost unwatchable. It has some really incredible moments, but as a cohesive film, I don't think Darjeeling works. Life Aquatic, I'm on the fence about. Again, I think there are some good moments, but I think Life Aquatic, he totally out-clevers himself and is going for these amazing, clever things. And they just become disruptive to the cohesion of the actual film. The other thing is we're talking about somebody whose oeuvre is not enormous. We're talking about like 7 films. So, you know, to put it at, I'd say it's 3 or 4, you know, it's that depending on the day, it might be somewhere in there with Tenenbaums or Rushmore or Tenenbaums or Bottle Rocket.
I feel like I'd put it around Fantastic Mr. Fox just because it wasn't really doing a lot for me. Like, I definitely liked it, but I feel as though the second half makes up for the first half, but I feel with the qualities of the first half, it's going to be lower on my list.
Yeah.
What's your Rockfist ratings?
Huh?
Rockfist
rating. Am I going first?
Yeah,
I'll go first. You know, I think I'm really on the fence because, like, the ending, it's going to be up. I'm just on the fence between minor and solid.
Same.
Can it be a middle? I think I have to go minor because I don't want to raise expectations to such an extent. That people will go in thinking that this is a hugely positive review. But, man, that last half, if I could just rate the last half, it'd be solid to almost way up. So I'm going to go minor because of the problems in the first half. But it is a high minor rock fist up.
I agree. Ditto.
A high minor. They just invented a new one, Eric.
Yeah,
Sounds like a new rock band. High minor.
It's a medium minor, high minor. There's a new scale that we sent them to.
Right.
So that's Moonrise Kingdom. Two minor rock fists up.
I think we should keep the tray wagon rolling and let's do a little verses before Eric and I get into Ted.
Yeah, I was one of 2 critics at this screening, so not a whole lot of love shown to Lola Versus. All right, so this stars Greta Gerwig and was co-written by Zoe Lister-Jones and was directed by Daryl Ween. It is about a woman, Lola, who is 29, planning her wedding. She's engaged to a guy named Luke, they're planning the wedding, and Luke has something of a breakdown early on, just kind of an emotional breakdown, doesn't quite know what he's doing, breaks off the engagement, leaving Lola single for the first time in many, many years. This is, a few months before her 30th birthday. So she's basically just, you know, in crisis, single, you know, lost, and continuing to obsess over her ex, Luke. And that's basically, you know, that's basically the synopsis of this film. It's you know, it's her coming to grips with sort of who she is. And it's sort of in the vein of the sort of independent New York-based romantic comedy. There are moments where it feels a little Annie Hall-ish, less androcentric, definitely. I mean, but there are moments where it feels kind of like that. They allow New York to kind of play a part. And I really actually got into that because I think New York, almost like as a metaphor for the vastness of the world, there are just, you know, millions and millions of people there, and you just kind of feel lost. And so the big buildings and all of the people can actually serve to isolate somebody. So I thought it actually worked really well.
So just to be clear, it's not a live-action adaptation of the Kinks concept album, Lolo versus the Power Man?
No, it is not. It is
not. I don't want to see it.
Yeah, so... You know, I realize that probably a lot of people are gonna be on the fence about this because it's a rom-com, but Jones, she was trying to remove a lot of the sentimentality, basically a lot of the gloss from the idea of a rom-com. So it becomes much more sort of this awkward, really funny exploration of relationships and the personas that you project in relationships and who you really are and that kind of stuff. It's always amusing. Sometimes it's like genuinely uncomfortable and funny.
So it's fun comfortable.
Yeah, it's fun comfortable. It is fun comfortable. And there are a number of like there isn't a single glossy sex scene. I just finished writing my review, and I mentioned the sex scenes because even the good ones, even the good ones are just like, it's like, oh, it's an opportune moment and we'll get this over with quickly. That's as good as the sex gets in this movie. And most of the time it is significantly more awkward and uncomfortable than that. And it was just, you know, in some ways that's kind of really refreshing because it's just like, oftentimes, you'll see, a sex scene portrayed in a movie and you're like, man, all of these people are having all of this awesome sex that I'm not having. And then it's like, you go and see a movie like Lolo Versus and you're like, oh, I can understand that. Yeah, that's really awkward. That's really uncomfortable. And, you know, and so it was like, it was actually really, it was refreshing. And I think in part that's because this was co-written by, it was co-written by a woman. And so I think in part we're seeing, and the main character is Lola. So the main character is a woman. So, I mean, I think it's just kind of an interesting take on the whole thing. I've been surprised at how much I have thought about this film since seeing it. I think Gerwig and Jones both do a great job. I can't remember the actor's name. He was also in The Future. He plays Henry. So the actor who plays the character Henry, who's kind of the best friend of Lola and Alice. He was very good. Bill Pullman and Deborah Winger show up as Lola's parents. And it's kind of fun to see them. They're sort of afterthoughts, but, you know, as far as their characters. But, you know, on the whole, I thought that this was a refreshing take on a romantic comedy. It's largely unsentimental about the whole thing. There are a couple of things where the directing style is pretty hands off. So it's lots of mediums and wides, and because of that sort of hands off approach, there are moments that put way too much pressure on the actors to convey the story all on their own shoulders, because you'll like hold a shot where somebody has to like freak out or break down. And, you know, some more hands-on directing could have pushed that emotion better, like in a more convincing way. And so there are a couple of moments where the acting kind of bobbles, but I think it's really much more on the shoulders of the director to convey that emotion, or to help his actors convey that emotion. But for the most part, I really enjoyed this. And this is another one that I've kind of been struggling with. And I think that it's got enough flaws in it. You know, there's some moments that seem crafted in a way that you know, doesn't feel intentional. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of foundation of the film structure kind of starts showing through in a way that wasn't intended. But there are some really interesting things that this film does, and I think it should be applauded for those. And there's some genuinely funny moments in there. Most of the time between Lola and Alice, the best friend. And so I'm going to give this one a minor rock fist up. Again, it's just like, you know, I feel like if I gave it a solid rock fist up, it would be raising expectations way too high. But I think that there are some things about this film that make it a total worthwhile watch. So I'm giving it minor rock fist up.
All right. Sounds good. The awkward sex scenes, I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't relate to those.
Because you only have the glossy, awesome sex scenes
yep.
in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
It's all highlight footage.
Yeah, it's all Legends of the Fall for you.
Yeah. Speaking of worthwhile, what was it, a worthwhile viewing experience? Is that how you described it? Eric,
yes.
Let's talk about Ted, your favorite movie of the year.
What? I don't... Trevin and I...
I'm laying into you about it because I didn't talk to you after the movie. I didn't want to talk to anybody after it, but I did talk to Alan tonight after seeing Safety Not Guaranteed, and he informed me that you were not pleased with the movie.
I hated Ted. Ted is rarely does a movie come along that offends my personal sensibility so much that I give it a rock way down. I'm going to say right up, this is a rock way down. This is the most aggressively funny movie I've seen in a long time.
Real quick, can we check on Adam? I think he's about to go down. Adam, are you all right?
Adam, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm just listening.
Someone get him some water. Yeah. Someone get him some water. I think he's on his way down.
Yeah. Oh, you mean like, do you think I'm like falling asleep, or you think
yeah.
like
no,
like,
no,
yeah.
you're overheating.
No, yeah, I'm totally engrossed.
He's going down. He's going down. Get him some Gatorade.
So Ted was wonderful.
Ted is direct and written and stars the of Seth MacFarlane, who's the creator of Family Guy, which is a very long-running popular TV show that we're all familiar with at this point.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, why'd you have to explain it if it's so fucking popular?
I have never watched an episode of Family Guy from beginning to end because I always end up just thinking it is a bunch of nonsense thrown together, cheap jokes and the sequiturs and the obvious kind of humor, and it just doesn't appeal to me. So I've never really let it sink in. I was trapped in theater for 90 minutes forced to sit through the end of the movie that featured two very likable actors, Mark Wahlberg and Mila Kunis, going through motions and trying to be charming in a script that didn't really allow them to, especially poor Mila Kunis, who has to play the girlfriend of this guy, another one of these arrested comedies where this 40-something-year-old or 30-something-year-old schlub has learned to grow up. He has to be bitch who tells him to do that. Meanwhile, audience is waiting for this CG-animated wish-come-true tear continue his reign over Mark's life as the most important influence. And because it had such a cool, interesting, unbelievable premise that this little kid wishes this teddy bear to come and then has to deal with it once he's an adult. What a great premise. That's why this movie is so bad, because MacFarlane absolutely nothing with it. and his chauffeur is still...
So the premise is that this kid wishes for the bear to come alive, and he does.
And he does.
And then he grows up with this teddy bear.
Pretty much. And it kind of touches on the idea that, you know, when it first happens, the world acknowledges it, and it's kind of a miracle and everything. And then his 15 minutes of fame runs out, and he is just like, well, I'm still a talking bear. But, like, everyone's kind of done with him, so he just ends up being a slacker buddy, basically. So it turns into just this kind of slacker comedy.
Yeah, that's a clever bit of it, too, and that's the last clever part of the film.
That's kind of a bummer. I was expecting...
That's not the last clever part of the film. Eric and I disagree very much on this. I'm not a Family Guy fan. I have pretty much the same complaints about Family Guy that Eric does. Here's the thing. Ted is really formulaic. A lot of the conflicts don't really work. The actual B and C plots are pretty predictable and unaffecting, and it's longer than it really needs to be. It's about 2 hours. It wasn't 90 minutes, a little bit longer. Than 90 minutes, and if it had been 90 minutes, that would have been okay. There's actually, like, I can think of one very specific scene that didn't serve any purpose and just could have stood to be cut.
How about that kidnapping plot? That was funny.
Yeah. some funny stuff happened in there. Anyway, the thing that I give it a pass on, it's humor. I don't know why you're jumping on this and calling this homophobic and misogynistic and anti-Semitic, which, you know, those are elements of the humor, but it's one character's humor. It doesn't run through, not every character in the movie is that way. It's just one character.
No, those characters accept the things that he say as funny. So when he makes fun of people with speech impediments and Down syndrome, the other character laughs at it. When they talk about Jewish people, they both laugh at that. And the difference is that when Sacha Baron Cohen uses offensive shock humor, he's trying to point out hypocrisy, and he's trying to say that there are people in the world who you need to rethink who they are and their actions. This movie makes fun of people because they are gay. This movie makes fun of people because they're retarded. That's the kind of humor at play here. It's lowbrow, it's lowest common denominator, and sometimes there's not even jokes. Sometimes he just says something like, wow, that Superman Returns movie was really awful, or Jack and Jill, that was unwatchable, which is really ironic considering I'm in the middle of an unwatchable movie. So no joke. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible film.
No, it's not.
And I'm in the minority. Everybody was laughing around me. There were tons of people enjoying this film. I think this speaks to a bigger thing, and I'm hopefully going to have time to write about it on the site. There's a cultural divide in America, and I think that this movie represents that cultural divide. I mean, it really is insane the amount of, the little amount of imagination that goes into this kind of humor and the way people react to it and how strongly they do. It's like watching a Carlos Mencia stand-up routine, you know? I mean, it's that level of humor.
Yeah, and but it's, the stuff he's talking about...
Carlos Mencia stand-up routine?
What?
Apparently Eric likes to watch Carlos Mencia stand-up routines.
I've seen many clips, short clips. I've never seen one all the way through.
Uh-huh, yeah. Right. Whatever you say.
I'm just saying, man. I know I'm the minority on this, but I think people are giving it a pass.
You're a champion. You're a champion for the underdog.
I am that. This movie looked terrible. So.
Yeah. Well,
I thought the movie looked funny in the preview. I don't know.
It's got some great moments, I think. I mean, it really taps into some really what I was trying to get at.
Two great moments.
What I was trying to get at, the humor doesn't always work. The plot is totally formulaic. It's too long.
It looks like shit.
It's the smallest of recommendations I could give. But there are two scenes that are really put together. They're just hilarious and surreal. When he does jump cuts, a lot of the humorous jump cuts actually work. And it And it works in context. I mean, it's not the same as Family Guy, where it's just some random ridiculous situation they just cut away to. A lot of times it's anchored a little bit by the character's past or history or growing up in the 80s and loving, you know, 80s toys or Flash Gordon or things like that. They reference the things that he likes or loves and the sort of building blocks that the characters have together. I don't want to spend a lot of time taking apart a movie about a talking CG teddy bear, but there were a couple of moments that made me laugh really hard, and they weren't at the expense of anyone or anything. They were just surreal and ridiculous in that they committed to it as much as they did, and I really love everything about the Flash Gordon movie, so that helped a lot. I don't want to say anything more about that because they've kept that whole bit secret, and it's pretty
great. Those are the same two moments. I know the other moment you're talking about, it's when they have a disagreement. Those are the same two moments that I'm talking about. So we agree on something.
Yeah, they're except two funny moments.
The only charming parts of the entire film.
You know, I think there's definitely a few other bits and pieces that have some merit and have some humor. I mean, but I would never say, you know, that it's a perfect comedy or that it's
the ending. The ending is so unearned. They do this horrible sentimental
plea. I won't argue that. And the soundtrack is intentionally overdone.
And then the way it ends, like you've got this triangle between the girlfriend and Ted and Mark Wahlberg, the best friend, and the way that ends is also completely insulting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely broken. I mean, I'm not trying to debate the merits of plot here. I'm just saying.
All right, so what are the ratings?
We already know his. It's way down.
What's the second one?
Way down and minor up?
Minor up. Like this, the smallest recommendation I can give it.
Low minor as compared to our high minor.
Yeah.
All right. So what else do we have to talk about?
Last we've got is Safety Not Guaranteed. You and I just saw it. Yeah.
All right, that's you and I, Trevin, right?
I know, yeah. We got to go into that. Safety Not Guaranteed is a little independent movie. It's got some actors you'd recognize from television, Aubrey Plaza and Mark Duplass. Plaza from Parks and Rec and Duplass from The League are the two leads in the movie. There's a third actor, Jake Johnson, is that right?
I can't remember.
Yeah,
New Girl.
It's Jake Johnson from New Girl. He's the only other sort of recognizable face in the movie. Marianne Ryan-Staub, if you know who she is from 24, she's in it as well.
Mr. Show.
Yeah. So it's a really it's an independent movie about a girl and a guy, and the guy thinks that he knows how to time travel. She's working as an intern for a magazine. They find this classified ad about this guy who's trying to find someone to travel back in time with him. And they check it out. They want to do a story on it. And she kind of gets to know him, and he recruits her. He decides that she's going to be like his recruit, and they're going to move forward. And so it becomes one of those movies where, you know, is he crazy or is he not? Is it possible or is it not? You know, is there a conspiracy or did he make it up? And that's a big part of it. It's not a perfect movie by any stance. I don't know how you felt about the ending, Trey, but I was disappointed. It kind of does that same thing you were talking about with, we've talked about it before in movies like Take Shelter, where they kind of paint you into a corner. And it's like, is he, 'cause basically, you know, he's either crazy or he's not. That's what they work toward the entire movie. And they answer that question at the end. I mean, they kind of have to.
I mean, here's the thing is I found the, I can tell that you were a little dissatisfied with the ending. You know, I think that the ending is just ambiguous enough to be satisfying. 'Cause you sort of know what happens, but you kind of don't. Mm-hmm. 'Cause we see something happen, but we don't know exactly what's happened. Also,
right?
You know, they don't put too fine a point on it, I guess.
Sure.
So I actually found it really satisfying, and in some ways, it's a pretty ballsy choice.
Yeah.
So I tagged along. There was, you know, There was a lot that I really liked about
it. Same here. It's a charming movie, and Aubrey Plaza she kind of slips into the Parks and Rec mode every now and then, which is kind of her default character mode, where she's just unemotive and disinterested in everything.
Sure.
She kind of slips into that at times, and that can be kind of tiresome. But when she contrasts that with scenes where you actually get to see her be joyous, or be moved or happy about something, or to watch her kind of warm up to a character and all that, those moments are really compelling.
Oh,
and
great.
Are
yeah,
really
absolutely.
Well done. And Mark Duplass, I didn't know he had it in him, honestly. I mean, after watching The League, I mean, he's just sort of a bumbling dotard on The League. You know, he's just an idiot like everyone else on that show. I mean, a funny one, but still just kind of a schmo. And, he delivers a pretty complex, moving at times performance in the movie. And so based on the strengths of the leads, I like Jake Johnson a lot. His character goes through some stuff, and I thought some of the camera work that they used during his big meltdown at that sports arena, or not
yeah.
sports, but that sport world, that sort of go-kart, bumper car thing, I thought that was a great scene, and I think it was almost entirely due to the camera work and just kind of holding on him, even though he was like driving, you know, around a racetrack or in bumper
yeah,
cars
yeah,
or things like
that.
That ghost cart scene was great.
That ghost cart scene that is fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, overall, I was pleased. It does kind of slip into indie movie schmaltz mode at times. Yeah, totally. I mean, it toes the line, but it steps over it at times, and that kind of takes me out of it. For instance, there's a camping scene where he just at random whips out what was that instrument again?
Trey? A zither.
Yeah, just whips out a zither for no reason and plays the theme song of the movie and sings it to her. And I mean, they try and explain it
sure.
with the plot,
but
it's just so contrived.
Here's what did it for me in that scene. Is had he pulled out a guitar, had he
right.
pulled out a ukulele, had he pulled out, you know, a good handful of instruments, I would have tapped out. But the fact that Aubrey Plaza says, oh, is that a guitar? And he's like, no, it's a zither. And then pulls it out and sets it down.
Yeah.
I kind of was okay with that.
Yeah, for me, it was just kind of, I mean, it's still a silly moment that it just doesn't make any sense. There's no reason his character would be like, check this out. It's like
I feel a little weird talking about the camera work and specifically like the shot compositions because an acquaintance of mine, Ben Kosolke, was the director of photography on this film.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like Ben's stuff. Ben has shot films for Guy Madden. He's shot a ton of stuff actually. And he's really, really good. And he's really, really thoughtful, especially with like his texture shots or,
yeah.
you know, the shots that allow the film some breathing room. There's some really incredible shots of Aubrey Plaza walking in front of the sun as it's rising. And
right.
she's almost completely blown out and you can hardly see her. And it's just really, a really beautiful, beautifully composed shot. But it's this moment of, you know, of uncertainty, and she's not sure, her character's just not sure, you know, what she wants or who, you know, where she wants to go or who,
right.
who to believe, whether she should believe this guy who claims that he's a time traveler or believe, you know, the cynics who work for the magazine, and she's just not sure, but it's just, you know, it's one of those, it's a beautifully composed shot, and then it's a shot that allows you to think about what the character's thinking about. And I thought that those types of shots deployed really effectively.
So this movie was kind of a hit at Sundance. Does it have any anchor potential?
I don't know that it's going to blow up huge. I mean, I think that it's methodical in a way that, I don't know that it's going to play to a huge wide audience. It might get a little bit more of an audience, and I hope it does because there's a lot to like about this film.
Mm.
but I just don't know that it's, I don't know that it's mainstream enough. Like, there are times that it sounds like a pop song, but then you're like, oh, that's too thoughtful for radio play. You know, if that makes
it just sense. Doesn't have a, it just doesn't have a major hook at any point, if you want to keep that metaphor going. There's not, you know, I think of other movies in sort of a similar vein that were successful, whether you liked them or not. I mean, Garden State kind of jumps to mind, movies like that. And there's not a strong enough hook, whether it's a star
I mean, I
or
think
a formula. But there's not anything there strong enough to really. I think it'll connect with some people. Some people very profoundly will like it, and name it their favorite movie of the year and talk about how understated it is, and they'll be right. You know, like it's I don't think it's the best movie of the year or anything like that, but I think it's going to fly under the radar, and a lot of people are going to that do watch it are going to be beholden to it. I give it a solid rock fist up. I was pleased with it. It did enough right that I was able to forgive the things that kind of took me out of the movie momentarily. So yeah, I thought it was strong and really enjoyed it. So.
Yeah, I gave this a solid rock fist up also. You know, I think that the fact that it is trying to actively break formula and just do something that is really kind of a really well-composed character study kind of around a gimmick or it's something that could become really gimmicky quickly and it never does, I thought it was really – I found it surprisingly good.
Same here. And Jake Johnson, I loved his storyline and what his character did, and I loved how that concludes where there's no actual conclusion.
I mean, and that's kind of the way the whole film does. There's nothing tied up in a simple pat answer.
Right.
But yeah, Jake Johnson,
so
I thought was great.
That safety is not guaranteed.
Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying. Awesome. So did we cover them all?
We hit them all. That's it. So go see Ted. Eric says Ted, rock fist way up.
Ted
is rock fist way down from Eric.
Eric liked Ted. Trey loved Moonrise Kingdom. He said it was the best Wes Anderson movie he'd seen.
All time.
Adam agreed.
The greatest time. Probably just the best movie I've ever seen in my whole life.
And we both agreed that the worst part about Lola Versus were the sex scenes because they were so underproduced and just bad.
Yeah.
and then Safety Not Guaranteed was uninspired and just kind of crappy. Is that right? I think that's how it.
And then Spider-Man, minor rock fist up. Solid rock fist up.
Solid.
All right. Sounds good.
Well, I'm saying the only reason I could ever be interested in that is as long as there's a shot of Spider-Man in front of a huge American flag again. Mm-hmm. I really want that in this one.
If he could salute it this time, I would really appreciate that.
It's in the background in one shot, but that's it.
Or, if it gets knocked off a building and he goes out of his way to, swing down and grab it and plant it back on top of the Brooklyn Bridge and salute it and then goes back to fighting crime. I don't know why that hasn't happened yet.
That's a really good idea.
The next one, I'm sure.
They're gonna see this and say, that's $1 million idea.
We've got to do that.
I have to go spend 2 hours writing about how much I hate Ted, so I got to go.
All right,
I'm going to hit end. Adios, everyone.
See you.